So good evening. Before just moving into the talk, I just want to say I'm so inspired and honored to be here with you all. Your practices and your engagement with the difficulty, the accomplishments, the energy, it's just so inspiring. So inspiring that I could ride that energy to put this talk together. You know, it's a haul for us teachers too. And we're right in the crux, right in the middle of things for those of us that have been here for just P1. And I guess maybe 2/3 for those of you who have been here since the beginning. And stuff is popping. And settling, and expanding, and focusing, and just every which way that one might be. We're all bringing this together to find our way on this journey towards freedom. So, thank you for your practice. So I'm going to talk a bit about some reflections I have in relationship to the Four Noble Truths. And one of the reasons why I like speaking about the Four Noble Truths and actually get very excited about it is because this is the component of the Dhamma, of the practice, that came out of the man's mouth on the moment after he was enlightened. So just think about that. So there's all these other aspects of practice that kind of, you know, machinated and integrated and metabolized, which he spoke about, but coming right out of that experience, this is the clarity. So the energy on that, magnificent, don't you think? So I get very excited about the Four Noble Truths and both the simplicity and the challenge of it all. So it's said that the Buddha said, where there is attachment to the pleasant and aversion to the unpleasant, liberation is not possible. From the Samyutta Nikaya, the Blessed One was once living at Kasambi in a wood of some sapa trees. He picked up a few leaves in his hand and asked the bhikkhus, how do you conceive this, bhikkhus? Which is more, the few leaves that I have picked up in my hand or those in the wood? The leaves the Blessed One has picked up in his hand are few, Lord. Those in the wood are far more. So too, bhikkhus, the things that I have known by direct knowledge are many. The things I have told you are only a few. Why have I not told them? Because they bring no benefit, no advancement in the holy life, and because they do not lead to dispassion, to fading, to ceasing, to stilling, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. That is why I have not told them to you. And what have I told you? This is suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. That is what I have told you. Why have I told it? Because it brings benefits and advancement in the holy life, and because it leads to dispassion, to fading, to ceasing, to stilling, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. So, bhikkhus, let your task be this. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. The unhappiness of humanity can be overcome through spiritual means as opposed to material or physical This teaching of the Four Noble Truths is one of the central teachings of the way that the Buddha taught. The way. The Theravada school of Buddhism holds this sutta as the quintessence of the teaching of the Buddha. It is held that this one sutta contains all that is necessary for understanding Dhamma and for enlightenment. The first teaching of the Buddha upon his awakening is often called the turning of the wheel. It is the teaching he gave to his former ascetic spiritual friends. Those friends became his first followers. A big part of what makes this teaching so monumental and important is because of the comprehensive and ultimate scope. Practicing and moving beyond words into the lived experience of each moment, we can realize how this core teaching is the beginning of the various doorways of the teachings we engage with, ultimately being propelled along the path to freedom. Each teaching is a doorway into another teaching. The Four Noble Truths lead to the teaching of the Brahmaviharas, which lead to the characteristics of impermanence and non-identification. We can look to see through our attention and awareness as it manifests the truth of this experience. In the Dharma, there are no separations. Like a 3D hologram, one can enter at any point, and the truth will be illuminated and known by the heart-mind through wisdom. I invite you, as one of my teachers, Larry Yang, suggested, to explore and witness the unfolding of these bold truths, of these revealing truths, of these beautiful truths, and these inspiring truths. The Buddha proclaims the truths he realized, the Four Noble Truths. He states the truth and defines its meaning and describes each truth from three perspectives, the three turnings of the wheel of Dhamma. The first turning is the wisdom that illuminates the particular nature of that noble truth. The second turning is the understanding that each noble truth imposes a particular task to be accomplished. Thus, the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, is to be fully understood. The second truth, the truth of suffering's origin, craving, is to be abandoned. The third truth, the truth of cessation of suffering, is to be realized. And the fourth truth, the truth of the path, is to be developed. So to be fully understood, to be abandoned, to be realized, and to be developed, there's some activity in there. There's some engagement with the practice. The third turning of the wheel is the understanding that the four functions have been completed. The truth of suffering has been fully understood. Craving has been abandoned. The cessation has been realized. And the path has been fully developed. It was only when he understood the Four Noble Truths in these three turnings and 12 modes, he says that he could claim that he had attained unsurpassed perfect enlightenment. Again, monks, in regard to dhammas, one abides contemplating dhammas in terms of the Four Noble Truths? And how does one, in regard to dhammas, abide contemplating dhammas in terms of the Four Noble Truths? Here one knows as it really is. This is dukkha. One knows as it really is. This is the arising of dukkha. One knows as it really is. This is the cessation of dukkha. One knows as it really is. This is the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. From the Digha Nikaya. So here are these Four Noble Truths, these first teachings after the Buddha found freedom from his own suffering. Understanding that in life there is suffering. There are moments of dukkha, sometimes just fleeting suffering, and there are long periods of what sometimes seems intractable, permanent suffering. There are times of deep, intense suffering, and moments of subtle, just barely detectable suffering, but suffering nevertheless. Understanding, accepting, and knowing this, and the meaning of these noble truths, is the gateway to wisdom and the illumination of the path to freedom. Understanding that the cause of the suffering is clinging to desired objects and states of being, and having aversion and delusion as to how things are, not accepting things as they are, wanting them to be different. Joseph Goldstein has said, if you are struggling with something, most likely there is something in the experience or the condition that you are not accepting. Understanding there is an end to suffering, that you can release suffering by letting go of the clinging or putting down those desires. Understanding that there is an eightfold path to freedom from suffering that you can follow like a guide and integrate into your worldview and live from. These four ennobling with dignity or honor, inspiring. These four ennobling truths are the foundation of Buddhist wisdom. When integrated and metabolized into our view and understanding, there becomes the possibility of clarifying the mind-heart so that it no longer inclines towards suffering. Winnie spoke a lot about that last night. Suffering or dukkha is the common bond of experience that all beings share. All beings since the beginning of time. All beings, no matter what social or economic standing, race, ethnicity, or religious beliefs, those who have different sexual orientations or relationship to gender, those with privilege, who are most disenfranchised and desperate. The thing that bonds us and binds us in our commonality is this experience of knowing suffering. This understanding is the way into to wake up and stir our capacity for bringing compassion forward, both for ourselves and others. The wars, enslavement, the decimation of peoples, the degradation of our planet, and disrespect, terrorism, and harm done to our animal relatives are all the direct manifestations of greed, aversion, and delusion that can only exist because of the denial of the interconnectedness of all things. If we humans could see clearly this fact, that we all share this common bond of suffering, it would leave us incapable of doing these things and inflicting harm and causing more suffering. Kitisaro, one of my teachers and one of the teachers that actually teaches here, and BCBS says that the Four Noble Truths may not be a very fashionable teaching. You know, it may not be that exciting, but it is an extremely profound one. Wherever we are, when dukkha arises, we have a pathway to peace. In calming meditation, we develop strength of mind through the practice of steadying attention on the breath, the body, or chosen objects of contemplation. In insight meditation, we take that same strength of attentiveness and bring it directly to the experience of dukkha as it is felt in the body and the heart. We do this in a very particular way by neither justifying nor trying to fix the pain, neither being overwhelmed nor shaped by it, nor repressed or distancing ourselves. The art of meditation is to meet dukkha directly, to breathe with it, and inquire into it. A poem by Rilke. Unafraid of what is difficult. Don't be confused by the nature of solitude. When something inside you wants to break free of your loneliness. This very wish, when you use it as a tool for understanding, can illumine your solitude and expand it to include all that is. Bound by conventions, people tend to reach for what is easy. It is clear, however, that here we must be unafraid of what is difficult. For all living things in nature must unfold in their own particular way and become themselves at any cost and despite all opposition. It is helpful to have the understanding that the Buddha speaks of three types of suffering. The suffering caused by physical and mental pain. We've heard a lot about that, sickness, aging, and death. The suffering caused by physical and mental pain. Suffering caused by constant change or anicca. Life's constantly changing nature. Impermanence. The third type of suffering, anatta, not self, it arises because all things in this life are of a conditional nature. This type is the subtlest and hardest to recognize, to know that each moment of experience is composed of five components or aggregates, contact, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. For each of the truths, there are three aspects, and therefore, there are 12 insights that arise out of the understanding of the truths. The first noble truth. What is the noble truth of suffering? Birth is suffering. Aging is suffering. Sickness is suffering. Dissociation from loved is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. In short, the five categories affected by clinging are suffering. There is this truth of suffering. Such was the vision, insight, wisdom, knowing, and light that arose in me about things not heard before. The noble truth must be penetrated by fully understanding suffering. Such was the vision, insight, wisdom, knowing, and light that arose in me about things not heard before. This noble truth has been penetrated by fully understanding suffering. Such was the vision, wisdom, knowing, and light that arose in me about things not heard before. From the Samyutta Nikaya. Truth one. There is suffering, dissatisfaction, frustration, pain, sorrow, misery, imperfections, and stress. Any of that sound familiar to anybody? Yeah? The first noble truth is not saying that everything is suffering. It is not a metaphysical statement of doctrine about the absolute. The noble truth is a truth to reflect upon. Western minds in particular find it challenging to understand this because it is interpreted as a metaphysical truth, but that is not it at all. You know, so I think it was back in July, I did this retreat called the Lost Coast Retreat. And so it was in Northern California, and the retreat center is located in a place that you can only access by walking in 9 miles from a particular point. So I did this retreat. I planned to do it for a couple of years, and I did all this training. You're right. Right, like I even did my little 3 miles, did my little 6 miles. Like, oh, if I can do 6 miles, I can do 9 miles. But I'm walking on the flat surfaces of the tarred streets of New Jersey. And this Lost Coast retreat was literally on this craggy line, shoreline, of 9 miles in Northern California. And I bought all the right accoutrements, you know, the right socks and the right walking shoes. And I had my poles and, you know, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do this 9 miles. And I went with a very good friend of mine. And we started out on this on this walk. And really, it was, I don't know, maybe not even a third of a mile. And I was like, I cannot do this. And one of the things that was, even people that do this walk said this was one of the most difficult because there was no packed sand for 9 miles. It was all that kind of sand where your foot just sinks in. And so I turned to my girlfriend and I said, I can't do this. My mind hijacked my intention. And she taught me down off the ledge. And what I was aware of is that I only had that moment to decide to move forward or to choose to move forward. Because once I got a little further, the only way out was for some helicopter to come get me and drop down one of those lines and lift me up. So I really was at that choice point where I had to harness and gather all that I knew to be true and so in terms of the practice and stay true to my Sangha, my girlfriend, my Kalyanamita, who we had decided we were going to do this together, and decided to continue to move forward. Now, the whole along the way, there were 24 of us, I think it was, and there were maybe 5 of us who were older, let's say 60 and over. And the whole way, I was the last person. So my mind's working with that. You know, y'all know, I've been hearing it in the room, you know, like, what's wrong with me? I trained, I bought the right stuff. What's happening? Am I going to be able to walk tomorrow? all along the way, and by virtue of being the last person, so this is the struggle of practice. By virtue of being the last person, because we took rest stops, but every time I got to it, like a minute after I got there, we were up and going again. which is kind of oppositional to one that, you know, really needs to catch a breath, can't catch a breath. So for the three rest stops, you know. So the first part of the moving into the retreat, we were talking. And then it was kind of divided up into three walks. And then the second part, we started to really move into silence. And then the last part was fully in silence. And it's through the support and friendship of not just May, the girlfriend that I went with, but Aya Ananda Bodhi and Susie Harrington, who came back, and Susie talked to me the whole part of the second way. So she helped my mind to land and to focus and to become gathered, this interaction that we were having. And Aya Ananda Bodhi walked with me in silence all of the third part of the way. And I was really clear that the only thing that was moving me forward was my intention and my practice. But had it not been for this practice, that wouldn't have happened. And this is just an aside. So when we got to the last 2 miles or so, Susie runs back and she says, "We're almost there, you can make it, you're doing good." But the last, so we'd walked 7 miles. And to get to the last 2 miles, you had to scale this sheer wall. That was about 5.5, 6 feet tall. And I looked at, talk about a hindrance. I looked at it and I was like, I don't know how I'm gonna get up this. And so I'm at the bottom and I'm just really trying to prepare myself to scale this. And there's a retreatant at the top. He's got his hand reaching down and I'm like, "Are you sure you can hold me? I'm a big girl, you know." He said, "No, I got you." So he's pulling me. I'm using my energy to move up. And this is just for you. Aya Ananda Bodhi comes behind me and she says, "I'm going to put my hand on your butt and I'm going to push." So it was through this effort of this community of people and the practice that I had cultivated that I successfully walked those 9 miles and got to the retreat center. But that's often how it feels like when you're on the cushion. It's like, "Are you kidding me? I'm done with that. Can I get this sand out of my shoe?" Anyway. So reflecting on the first noble truth, that there is suffering, is the first insight. The recognition and accepting that there is suffering actually then empowers us to notice and investigate suffering in our own life. However, this seemingly simple recognition provides a core domain of suffering in which we design whole lives around avoiding the recognition and acceptance of this truth. Like, really, that's what, you know, it's on one hand, it's so simple. Really, there is suffering. Not when it rains, not when it's sunny, not when it's winter, not when it's summer. There is suffering. But the interesting thing is, or the thing that you all and we all have been working with over this time together, is even with that recognition, the understanding that there's nothing to be done to change that circumstance. That's a particular price we pay for being embodied. You know, for having a nervous system. And what this practice, what this understanding, what the Buddha Dhamma Sangha offers us is a way of understanding and engaging with this truth such that we begin to be able to find some freedom and move towards authentically manifesting who we are. Ignorance of this insight is what causes us to claim the suffering, claiming it, clinging it, and then proclaiming, "I don't want to suffer," making it personal, then engaging in all kinds of activities and actions to avoid the recognition of this truth. I meditate, I go on retreats to get out of suffering, but I still suffer, and I don't want to suffer. What can I do to get rid of this suffering? How can I get out of it? The activation of the clinging and aversion and delusion gets set once again into motion. The first noble truth is not, I am suffering and I want to end it. The insight is, there is suffering. This is a basic insight, to look at how things are with clear perception and acceptance is to be empowered and sets the stage for being completely honest with ourselves about the suffering we are experiencing. Without this wise view, it is easy to ignore, suppress, or flee from the knowledge of what is so, and to put the blame on circumstance for the presence of unsatisfactoriness and pain in our lives. When we break the noble truths down and look at the three insights accompanying each statement of a truth, it assists us in clearing obstruction to wise view so that we can engage with our practice and find balance and stability for a foundationally well-lived life. The three aspects of each of the noble truths has a pattern. There's a statement, then the prescription, and then the result of having practice. We can also understand that this, through the use of the Pali words, Pariyatta, Patipatta, and Pativeda. Pariyatti is the theory or the statement, there is suffering. Patipatti is the prescription, the practice, actually practicing with it. And Pativeda is the result of the practice. Ajahn Sumedho speaks of this as the reflective pattern, where we are actually developing our minds in a reflective way. He says a Buddha mind is a reflective mind that knows things as they are, and that we use these four noble truths as the vehicle for our development. The three aspects of the first noble truth, there is suffering. The second aspect being, suffering should be understood. And the third aspect, suffering has been understood. These are helpful guideposts to fully knowing this to be true at the level of our bones. To look at the pain and anguish we may feel not from the perspective of it's mine, I own it, it's me, but as a reflection, there is suffering. This is suffering. The insight being to look at the suffering and see it as dukkha and not as a personal misery, and not reacting to it in a habitual or aversive way. Life is stressful and uneasy for all people, everywhere. If you are embodied, there is no way out, no way to escape. No one is exempt. The full acceptance of our commonality and connection through this truth is the wellspring from which to move towards kindness and compassion, forgiveness and generosity of heart. It can be helpful to make the distinction between what is termed suffering and pain. The suffering that the teaching refers to and offers relief from is the internal suffering that we cause ourselves due to not seeing clearly, due to clinging and delusion and pushing away, and due to not developing the heart qualities that send the roots of courage and strength deep. That internal suffering is different from the external pain of the world. Conflict, catastrophe, loss, abuse, oppression, trauma, war. The teachings do not say that it is possible to live this life free from pain of these external conditions. These are the sorrows of the 10,000 sorrows and the 10,000 joys that it is said make up a lifetime. There can be a great deal of resistance at accepting this truth, as it would then entail having to become responsible to our lives. And that takes courage and commitment. For many people, it is not so far-fetched to understand suffering in the big picture as it is acceptable to suffer behind loss, physical challenges, mental challenges, financial devastation, at least for a time. Although there is the expectation within our culture, within these minds conditioned through the experience of Western society, that somewhere, somehow, the point is we should get it together. However, when one is living an okay, pretty good life, a tendency more often is to deny the more subtle aspects of suffering caused by the mind's wanting and needing and reactivity. By denying the suffering in our lives, one is prevented from responding wisely to it. This then begets more suffering, and there we go, caught up in the vicious cycle to nowhere. So the story I shared with you about the Lost Coast, which happened in April, kind of is illustrative of the development of engagement and trust and passion that I have for this practice, as opposed to this next story, which was about 10 years ago. So I was kind of in the middle of the years of practice. And some of you will remember this. Some of you maybe were too young for it to have affected you immediately. But about 10 years ago, there was a downturn financially in this country. Some people experienced it as a recession. Some people experienced it as a depression. And during that time, I call it my 2 years of living dangerously. I was engaging with the practice and really caught by my intentions for cultivation of heart and mind, while at the same time, first thing that happened was my husband lost his job. Like, okay, well, we can deal with that. We'll work with it. Then about 3 months later, he fell and broke his arm. This was 10 years ago. My husband's 70, so he was 60 when this happened. I was like, okay, can deal with that. Then about 4 months later, my father died after having had dementia for 15 years. That was kind of like, okay. All right, it's enough. About 4 months after that, I was informed. I used to be the director of trauma services at Garrison Institute. I was told my job was going to be phased out. So my husband had lost his job, remember, at the beginning of the story. So I described to people that I was going through this period where it felt like if anyone's ever run track, you know that when you run the hurdles, you have to start preparing for the next hurdle the minute your foot hits the ground after coming down out of the hurdle that you just jumped over. And that's what this period, it's like I could hardly catch my breath. And I remember, you know, so I was told I was going to lose my job. Then 3 months later, I did complete and wasn't working there anymore. And we had this house that we owned. And for a year, that's why I call it my 2 years. So all this stuff happened the first year. And in that second year, I did everything I could in terms of the clinging and attachment to not only the house, but what the house represented in terms of success, in terms of all the effort that my parents had made such that their children could access what had been more difficult for them. You know, to be, at that time, let's see, I guess, so to be 52 and faced with the possibility that gonna lose the house, have to move back in with my mom. We have a good relationship, my mother and I. But at 52, you're not thinking about moving back in with your mom. At least for me, some people. I remember standing in the doorway of the passage between the front of the house and moving into the kitchen, almost dropping to my knees with the suffering that was the result or caused by this holding on to a perception of how it should be. It took me to my knees, such that it became so difficult and so painful to continue in that state that I was almost forced, like there was some dawning, like, oh, let it go. I can't hold it anymore. I can't cling. So this wasn't some intellectual, this was like a heart-grabbing moment. This is nothing I figured out. It was nothing that even arose from the place of cognition or cognizing. This was actually the heart informing, bolstered and cultivated through the practice, such that I didn't know it then, but after the fact, what I told people was the only way I made it through those 2 years with my sanity was because of the practice. And it's actually that moment, that circumstance, that provided the trajectory that has me be sitting up here before you tonight. So, there is little room for being a full expression of being human in a society that is based on pleasure, immediate gratification, overstimulation, ego deification, and which extols the merits of overconsumption and defines success as your ability to control outcomes. Well, I guess I moved through all of that. The illusion and delusion of that. The second aspect of the first noble truth, suffering is to be known or understood. This is the pause I am suggesting we take and what we are up to in these days and weeks. To engage with the practice such that we see clearly this second insight that dukkha is something to understand. That the way to freedom is to understand the nature of this insight and not just to try and get rid of it. What we have all been saying, meaning us teachers who have been speaking with you and meeting with you and holding you dearly in our hearts, through our own experience and understanding, is this very thing. Another one of my teachers, Utejaniya, places at the very core of his teaching this. Do not run from the experience of suffering, but consciously and intentionally turn towards the experience and embrace the opportunity. Choose to be mindful of the actual experience of pain, stress, and emotional distress as it manifests in the body, heart, and mind. This allows for us to come to know and understand the true nature of our suffering as a lived physical experience. Got to bring it down out of the head and into the heart and the body. And to realize it is this awareness that can connect us to our own true humanity and to connection with all beings everywhere. The third aspect of the first noble truth, suffering has been understood. That is to know that you know. This knowing, if truly known, will call us to consciously and intentionally shift and alter our perspective to include the reality of suffering, thereby causing us to reshape our beliefs, and we then develop the ability to live more wisely right now. That was all just the first noble truth. So the second noble truth. What is the noble truth of the origin of suffering? It is craving, which renews being and is accompanied by relish and lust, relishing this and that. In other words, craving for sensual desires, craving for being, craving for non-being. But whereon does this craving arise and flourish? Wherever there is what seems lovable and gratifying, thereon it arises and flourishes. There is this noble truth of the origin of suffering. Such was the vision, insight, wisdom, knowing, and light that arose in me about things not heard before. This noble truth must be penetrated by abandoning the origins of suffering. This noble truth has been penetrated by abandoning the origin of suffering. Such was the vision, insight, wisdom, knowing, and light that arose in me about things not heard before. Samyutta Nikaya. Reflecting on the second noble truth with its three aspects, there is a cause or origin of suffering. This is attachment to desire. Desire should be let go. Desire has been let go. Craving. Craving for, grasping for, or the attachment to sense pleasures. Craving for, or the attachment to existence. And craving for, or the attachment to non-existence. These are the dominant and most pervasive causes of suffering. The third aspect of insight for the second noble truth. There is the origin of suffering, which is the attachment to desire. Desire should be let go of. Desire has been let go of. We contemplate that the origin of suffering is attachment to desire. Desire in Pali is tanha. There are three aspects of desire we practice with. Kama tanha is wanting sense pleasure through the body or other senses and always seeking things to excite or please our senses. Then there is bhava tanha, where we can contemplate the feeling of wanting to become something, the desire to become, striving to become happy, seeking to become rich, or even to become important and respected by becoming immersed in an endeavor to make the world right, looking at one's motivations. This wanting to become something other than what you are right now. Then there is the third kind of desire, when we become disillusioned with becoming something. There is the desire to get rid of things. This is vivava tanha. We can contemplate the desire to get rid of. I want to get rid of my suffering. I want to get rid of this pain or this sleepiness. We are not trying to get rid of the desire to get rid of things, nor do we encourage that desire. We reflect. It's like this. This is what it's like to be like this. The second insight of the second noble truth is desire should be let go. The second noble truth is not about identifying with desire in any way, but about it recognizing desire. The third insight of the second noble truth is desire has been let go. The third noble truth. What is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering? It is the remainder, less fading, and cessation of that same craving, the rejecting, the relinquishing, leaving and renouncing of it. But whereon is this craving abandoned and made to cease? Wherever there is what seems lovable and gratifying, thereon it is abandoned and made to cease. There is this noble truth of the cessation of suffering. Such was the vision, insight, wisdom, knowing, and light that arose in me about things not heard before. Samyutta Nikaya. Reflecting on the third noble truth, the three aspects. There is an end of suffering. The cessation of dukkha or suffering should be realized. The cessation of suffering has been realized. The complete fading away and cessation of craving and attachment. Cessation from suffering can be achieved by forsaking, abandoning, liberating oneself, and detaching from craving, letting go, or putting down. Cessation extinguishes the flames of greed, aversion, and delusion. A whole aim of this practice and understanding is to develop a reflective mind in order to let go of delusions. The teaching of the Four Noble Truths is a teaching about letting go through investigation or looking into by contemplating. It does not mean that the mind is forming opinions or having judgments about whether or not things are bad or good, useful or useless. We are opening our minds to consider and ponder, what does this mean? One of the aspects of this practice and Dharma is we are not required to come to understanding through blind belief, but that we find wisdom after our willingness to be receptive and considering. It takes a willingness to actually look at our own reactions, to be able to see the attachments and to contemplate. We must allow things to arise, since before we can let something go, we have to admit or allow them into full consciousness. All of it, the despair, the anger, the disappointment, the hindrances, the joys, the energy of it all. Although cessation is easy to understand intellectually, to realize it may be difficult because this means, at times, being with or abiding with that which we cannot bear. The reality is, though, that the suffering and the point we break is at those places where not seeing it becomes more devastating than allowing it to arise and be seen and contemplated. In other words, as Ajahn Sumedho said, to allow this process of cessation to work, we must be willing to suffer. To allow this process of cessation to work, we must be willing to suffer. We need to remember that anything that arises ceases. We contemplate fear and desire so that we can see through Mara and so that we cannot be deluded anymore. Don't turn away. Keep your eyes on the wounded places. That's where the light enters. Rumi. The fourth noble truth. There is a path out of suffering. The way is the Eightfold Path. The path is established not on a technique, but on an understanding. The three aspects of insights for the Fourth Noble Truth are: there is the Eightfold Path, the way out of suffering. This path should be developed. This path has been developed. When he spoke about one aspect of the Eightfold Path last night, and I'm sure over the next couple of weeks we'll be speaking to others, so I'm not going to go into detail about that. However, just to remind you or to bring forward that the path, even though there's the path of eight, that it's broken down into wisdom aspects, concentration aspects, ethical conduct. So that just gives you a little bit in about this path that we develop, sometimes intentionally and consciously, and sometimes through the experience of our mind, heart, bodies. The Four Noble Truths are a lifetime's reflection. It is not just to gain understanding and wisdom by realizing the insight of the Four Noble Truths, the three aspects, and the 12 stages, and then going on to more advanced techniques, complicated theories, and ideas. The whole road to freedom is lit by the luminosity of the simplicity, yet wisdom, of the Four Noble Truths. By studying, understanding, practicing, and cultivating this path and the Four Noble Truths, a natural arising of an integrated life unfolds, grounded in a clear and luminous mind and a strong, graceful, compassionate heart. Thank you for your listening. Let's sit for a moment. So lastly, as we sit for a moment, you know I got a poem for you. She let go. She let go without a thought or a word. She let go. She let go of the fear. She let go of the judgments. She let go of the confluence of opinions swarming around her head. She let go of the committee of indecision within her. She let go of all the right reasons, wholly and completely, without hesitation or worry. She just let go. She didn't ask anyone for advice. She didn't read a book on how to let go. She didn't search the scriptures. She just let go. She let go of all of the memories that held her back. She let go of all of the anxiety that kept her from moving forward. She let go of the planning and all of the calculations about how to do it just right. She didn't promise to let go. She didn't journal about it. She didn't write the projected date in her day timer. She made no public announcement and put no ad in the paper. She didn't check the weather report or read her daily horoscope. She just let go. She didn't analyze whether she should let go. She didn't call her friends to discuss the matter. She didn't do a five-step spiritual mind treatment. She didn't call the prayer line. She didn't utter one word. She just let go. No one was around when it happened. There was no applause or congratulations. No one thanked her or praised her. No one noticed a thing. Like a leaf falling from a tree, she just let go. There was no effort. There was no struggle. It wasn't good, and it wasn't bad. It was what it was, and it is just that. In the space of letting go, she let it all be. A small smile came over her face. A light breeze blew through her, and the sun and the moon shone forevermore. Reverend Sapphire Rose. May we come to know the joy and peace and freedom of the ultimate willingness to let it all go. Have a restful